Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Listen, we have a great show lined up for you today, and I'm very excited to be speaking to the first pair of guests, not only because what this group does is so cool, and that is flying companion animals to their new homes, but also because I think it's a great example of how a little idea to help animals can take hold and grow and really become a wonderful and joyous thing for animals and for people. Later in the show, there is big news in the OSHA SeaWorld hearings, and Michael Mountain, who has been following the proceedings very closely, will be joining us. Following the death of Dawn Branshaw in February 2010, OSHA mandated a number of new and significant safety standards, which SeaWorld appealed. Michael will be breaking down the judge's decision for us. Also later in the hour, we're going to have news with Peter and a few new product reviews. First, transporting dogs and cats and other companion animals from shelters or rescues to their new adoptive homes can be a real challenge if the distances get too far. If you've ever taken a long car trip, say with your dog, you probably had to make many stops along the way for a potty break or just from anxiety or excitement. But really, if you're in, let's say, Austin, Texas, and the perfect adoptable dog whose life you can save is in Baton Rouge, how do you make that happen? Well, there are certain situations where the folks from Pilots and Paws will gladly fly animals like these to their destinations. I'm very pleased to welcome Debbie Boyce, who is co-founder and president of Pilots and Paws. She is a retired OBGYN nurse and a founding board member of Doberman Assistance Network. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Lori. Thank you for having us on your program.
And also with us is Patrick Regan, who wrote a very beautiful and inspiring book about Pilots and Paws, Dog is My Co-Pilot. Patrick is a very productive book author with more than 100 titles to his name. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So, Debbie, let's begin with you. You were involved in Doberman Rescue when the first flight of what was going to grow into Pilots and Paws occurred. Tell us about the origins of Pilots and Paws.
Pilots and Paws began due to my adoption of a rescue Doberman. I had, as you had mentioned, I worked in Doberman Rescue for a number of years, and when we lost our 12-year-old Dobie to cancer, my husband and I decided to add a rescue Dobe to our family. So that became a quest for me. So having the connections with other Doberman rescues, I was able to locate a dog in Florida who we determined had been used as a bait dog for fighting dogs, and he had gone through heartworm treatments, but he was loving, kind, and would be a perfect fit for our family. And I put out the word to our friends. I live in South Carolina, and the dog was in Florida. So I said, friends, if you're traveling this direction, would you think about picking up our Doberman and bringing him this way? My lovely friend in Knoxville, Tennessee, replied with, Debbie, why don't I just fly down and pick him up for you? And that was the start of it all. He did just that. He flew to Florida. He picked up our rescue dog. He brought him to me. He posed the question, is there a need for this? I said, John, you have no idea. His reply was, let's do something about it. I said, we need to. How about if we call it Pilots and Paws? And here we are today.
So after one successful transport, you really were thinking big, and that's what happened. That's really incredible story. And just for my listeners, you mentioned the poor Doberman who was a bait dog. I just want to let my listeners know, if they don't know, that's typically what dog fighters will use to train their dog fighting dogs. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. They have sparring partners. And they had filed all of his teeth down so that he could not be, you know, aggressively attacking them back. And
so they
do some other horrific things to them as well.
Right.
You know, we really don't want to think about, but it is a fact. It does happen. It is still happening out there. So he was saved from that life and has a loving home with our family now.
Well, you did a great thing. So, Debbie, who are the people needed to make this work? I mean, there must be a lot of coordination and cooperation.
Well, you know, there is, but what we really have done, Lori, is we've created a platform online, pilotsandpaws.org, and on that forum board, pilots can register to join if they want to volunteer, and rescues and shelters can register to request transport help from pilots. which they do, and an automatic email request goes out to the pilots once a person has said, hey, can you help me move these animals, or this cat, or this dog, or sometimes the pot-bellied pigs. We're an equal opportunity rescue flight operation. And once that happens, the request is made and a pilot can help, then the two parties work directly together. We feel that's very important because pilots are the only ones who know what type of weather they can fly in, the distance they can travel, for example. So we leave it in the pilot's capable hands, and the rescues and shelters really work together with the pilots in planning the whole transport.
And Patrick Regan, you've been listening quietly. Thank you. How did you first learn about Pilots in Paws, and what drew you toward them?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a writer, and I've written many books, and I was actually finishing up a project that I'd been working on for quite a while, and was returning some research materials to a woman who had helped me with that, and just in passing conversation, she had said, so what's next for you? And I said, well, I don't know. I'm kind of looking and thinking about it, and that was true. And then she happened to mention that her husband was flying that day, and I said, oh, is your husband a commercial pilot? And she said, no, he actually does rescue flights for animals. And in an instant, I knew what my next book was. It really hit me in a flash when I said, what do you mean he's flying rescue flights for animals? And she told me, and I thought, wow, that is a story. There's got to be a story. So in short order, I had met this person, Sam Taylor, who happens to live in the same city that I do, and is one of the heavy lifters for Pilots in Paws. He's flown approaching 300 animals now over the last 3 or 4 years. And he put me in touch with Debbie and John Warenberg, who are the founders. And with Debbie's blessing, after a few conversations, she didn't know who I was, so we had to get to know each other, she gave me permission to solicit stories and contact pilots and start trolling through their extensive web archives of stories. And so I started collecting, and at the same time, I actually was invited to fly on some rescue flights with Sam, who has become a very good friend. And now I'm a frequent co-pilot. As often as I can, I get up there and save dogs with Sam.
That's really cool. Patrick, you wrote about the power of the plane to compress time. Explain what you mean and why this is so valuable in animal transport.
Right. Well, I think I heard that first from John Warenberg, the co-founder. You had mentioned how the over-the-road transport, the automobile transports, have been around forever, that's great work that people do with that. But it can get extremely tenuous when you're making all those connections. I mean, some of those connections have 10, 15 transfers, and usually people are driving for an hour, and you're really putting stress on the animal and taking chances every time you're swapping cars at a highway rest stop or something like that. And sometimes, actually, time is of the essence. If you have an animal who is ill or about to have a litter of pups, which has happened many times, and this wonderful thing called the airplane lets you accomplish the same thing, but much faster. These pilots can fly generally 300 miles in a leg. Sometimes they go much further, but that's kind of average. And so they'll make a transport happen within a matter of hours, generally, instead of a matter of days or even weeks.
Now, Debbie, what animals need to get transported by air? Which ones need to fly and also are good candidates?
Well, actually, any rescue animal is a candidate for a rescue flight. Of course, there are your medical needs, as Patrick mentioned, that are a little bit more pressing. But all these animals, the majority of these animals are coming from kill shelters. Local rescues have looked through the list of the euthanasia list, and they've pulled specific dogs that they feel that they can help. And they typically need to get them out of the southern shelters. We see most of our requests coming from the south headed to the north. And, if we don't make these flights and these animals don't get on these flights, then perfectly adoptable animals are oftentimes euthanized. And it's not necessarily the shelter's fault. They only have so much room. And the overcrowding is rampant in the south. And so these animals, if we can get them connected with a pilot and get them on these planes and relocate them, then they have a chance.
So, Debbie, you must get a lot of calls. Do you have to do a lot of screening? And we only have a few seconds left in this segment, so if you could be brief.
As far as calls, I do get some calls, but it's primarily all web-based. So all the transactions take place online through making those requests.
And do you do the screening yourself?
The rescues are responsible for doing their screenings. The shelters, the sending and receiving locations are already predetermined before they come to Pilots and Paws and ask for our help. We're simply the conduit.
Very good. Very good. Okay, we're talking to Debbie Boyce and Patrick Regan about this really great book, Pilots in Paws, and really, really great organization as well, I should say. So don't go away. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner, and this is Animals Today. Hey, welcome back to the show. We're speaking to Debbie Boyce and Patrick Regan about Dog is My Co-Pilot. That's the name of this really fantastic book, Dog is My Co-Pilot. And it's really about Pilots and Paws, a wonderful organization that transports animals long distances, rescue animals primarily, to their hopefully permanent or sometimes temporary, but then permanent home. So really great organization. Debbie, who are the people receiving the animals, and how do you know they're going to accept the dog or cat or the animal, never having met him or her?
The screening process is done by the sending shelter or the sending rescue organization. Responsible mm-hmm. rescue groups are always going to check out who are receiving their animals, and for good reason. You need to make sure the animals are actually going to a better place. So that is left up to them.
Got it. Patrick, on the book jacket is a photo of you, Pilot Sam Taylor, and a dog named Enzo. Can you tell me the circumstances that got the three of you together in a rather small plane, and how did Enzo do?
Yeah, Enzo was a rescue dog. He was a Belgian Shepherd, and I can't remember exactly his backstory, but it was probably, you know, fairly sad, and I think he was given up on. A Belgian Shepherd is a working breed that requires a lot of, they need to be working, and so general owners can get frustrated with that breed. So Enzo was actually placed, he was on his way to a breed rescue in New Mexico that actually trains Belgian Shepherds specifically as service dogs, and he was great in the plane. Sam and I both fell in love with Enzo, and we were really hoping that there might be some kind of breakdown along the way, in which there would probably have been a breakdown between us because we would have fought over this dog. But he was delivered safely, and he's doing service work now.
Oh, wonderful. Debbie, speak a little further about the challenges in flying dogs in small planes. Are they in crates? Are they afraid? And mostly, have there been any dangerous situations caused by their presence?
Fortunately, no. No dangerous situations. We have... We provide, PetMate provides crates for us to give to our pilots, and also these wonderful auto safety harnesses. So I would say the biggest logistical problem for pilots and flying animals is size and weight. You know, these small planes are very controlled by size and weight. So the larger dogs often have to be tethered in the back seat with these safety harnesses, and we have not had, fortunately, any incidents of them getting loose. And typically what happens is the animals just fall asleep. Once they take off, and Patrick can tell you this because he's been on rescue flights as well, and so have I, and they just go to sleep to the hum of the engine. They may stir a little bit when you start the descent in the landing process, but other than that, they're perfect little passengers.
Wow. So you don't give them any sedative or anything like that?
No.
Yeah.
And in fact,
yeah.
We recommend that you... seek your veterinarian's advice if you
right.
have a highly agitated dog or one that's very nervous.
Sure.
We really don't recommend anything specifically be given to them.
Yeah. Debbie, what is the profile of your typical pilot? Are they animal lovers? And in the book, at least, I believe all of them were men. You could stand a few ladies, I'm assuming, right?
Oh, we have several women, female pilots,
actually. Oh, good.
Actually.
Good.
We have a lot of men, too. And we have some very young pilots that are just doing their first cross-country license. So, I would say that the average profile for most of our pilots is a working individual, white-collar, blue-collar, doesn't matter. Their commonality is they love to fly. And their second commonality is they love animals. So rather than just go up and burn fuel or go next door for a $100 hamburger, they are actually making these flights and saving lives. And we're a 501c3, so their flights are tax deductible as well.
Yeah, talking about that, what are the costs involved in making a flight, and who does pay? And you are a nonprofit organization, as you just mentioned. How are the funds you raised utilized?
The funds that we raise ourselves are used in many capacities. Of course, we have an education program that we're starting. We have different pet events and pilot events that we attend, which requires funding. So everything that we use really goes towards, you know, the advancement in animal promotion and awareness, basically. The pilots, because of the FAA regulations, general aviation pilots, unless they're freight hauling pilots, are not permitted to accept any monetary donations. So John, my co-founder, and I decided to become a 501c3 in order to classify our flights as humanitarian, which the FAA has done. And at the end of the year, they can claim a portion of their flight expenses as a tax deduction. So it's a little bit that we try and give back to the pilots.
How do the pilots learn about you?
The pilots learn about us through word of mouth and media, like yourself, Lori. I mean, we so appreciate you spreading the word about what we do. It was easy to reach the rescue organizations. If you're familiar with Animal Rescue, which I know you are, you send out one email blast and it literally goes around the world. And it's not as easy to reach the pilots, so we've had to be very diligent about pursuing where the pilots meet, their different clubs and organizations, and really spreading the word. And word of mouth is the best way, too.
Yeah. So, Debbie, I know you're transporting many other species besides dogs and cats, and for what reasons would they need to fly as well? Mainly medical?
Well, there's medical reasons, but there's also wildlife. There's quite a problem with snakes that have been let loose in Florida. I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but boa constrictors,
sure.
Pythons, they're really wreaking havoc on the ecosystem down there. So
one
of our Florida pilots has flown a lot of these snakes and monitor lizards and to wildlife rescues.
Yeah. Patrick, in the chapter titled All Species Airways, we meet Key West-based pilot Jeff Bennett, pictured with a large snake, a tortoise, a rooster, a guinea pig, and a number of other species. Patrick, is Jeff different from the other pilots?
He is different in that he probably represents, or I think definitely represents, or has flown the broadest number of species. He's also different because he is really a standard bearer. He just today, as we're speaking, I think is flying his 1,000th animal of his volunteer career. It's a big day for Jeff. And I think when I finished this book, he had just finished his 500th, so if anything, he's picking up the pace.
Yes,
that's
he did
wonderful.
Just complete that this morning, his 1,000th animal.
Wow, that's incredible. And then I know about the Scott Messenger also has transported more than 1,000 animals, right?
Yes, he's passed the 1,000 animal mark, and
wow.
I just received an email from him today. He flew 55 dogs this week.
Wow. Well, I just think what you're doing is so fantastic, Debbie. It's just really a wonderful thing for these animals that really are on death row and that need to get to a home quickly. Tell my listeners your website and where they can learn more about you.
They can learn more about us at pilotsnpaws.org. That's pilotsandpaws.org,
okay.
And you can read our stories. You can follow us on our fan page on Facebook and Twitter.
And, Patrick, the name of your book is?
Dog is My Co-Pilot.
Dog is My Co-Pilot. Thank you both so much.
Thank
next
you.
Next up, Michael Mountain and the SeaWorld hearings. Don't go away.
Welcome back. This is Peter Spiegel, and I am pleased to introduce Michael Mountain from Zoe. Let's go to zoenature.org. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good to be with you, Peter.
Yeah. So, okay, we finally have a ruling on the SeaWorld hearings, and we're going to ask you to explain it to us. But if you'd please take a minute first and tell us how it got this far.
Well, the first thing to bear in mind is that this is not specifically to do with animal protection as it is to do with human protection, or human protection as opposed to orca protection, because this was a charge filed by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, after trainer Dawn Branshaw was pulled into the water by this rather angry and depressed killer whale, Tillicum, and very sadly was actually taken to her death. And OSHA said that this was a case of willful neglect on the part of SeaWorld, and they require that certain steps be taken to actually separate the humans from the orcas when they're in the water together, saying that this right. is, at this point, a safety violation. It's just not safe for them to be in the water. So that's really what it was all about. And there were some fines as well, but the really key thing, and the thing that was really troubling to SeaWorld, is that if you can't have the orcas and the humans together in the water, this really ruins the whole Shamu show.
Right. So then, what was this recent hearing?
There were actually about 2 weeks of hearings. It went on for quite a long time. And SeaWorld was appealing this.
Yes.
And so that's what this was all about. And then the judge handed down what was a 42-page decision. He wrote really quite extensively about it. And the very first thing that he noted in his written decision was that there were no known cases anywhere ever of an orca having killed a human in the wild. He wrote, there are no known cases of killer whales killing humans in the wild. As far as the court can tell, all known injuries to humans have occurred from interactions with killer whales in pools. And so
yes.
that kind of sets the whole thing up as to the fact that this was not just an accident. I mean, this kind of thing should not be happening.
Very good. What were his main findings, and what did he say?
He went through everything that actually happened and what all the witnesses saw and so on. And there were various, a lot of it was really quite technical because SeaWorld was arguing, for example, that this wasn't really a show because the main show was over and you just have special guests at what they call their Dine with Shamu show, which is an evening dinner kind of thing where people look out of the window and the trainers are interacting with the orcas and feeding them fish and stuff like that. And SeaWorld said, well, that's not really a show. So there are all of these sort of legalistic points. And when SeaWorld said that the safety rules didn't really apply to this, the judge really didn't buy that at all. I mean, he just poured a whole lot of cold water on that. And he actually wrote, the court determines that Dine with Shamu was a performance that was still in progress when Tillicum seized Ms. Branshaw. And then he
yes.
goes on to explain what the court considers a performance to be. So all of these kind of legalistic type arguments that SeaWorld threw up, he just absolutely slapped down. And there were other things. I think probably the biggest one is that the and you may remember this from when the SeaWorld people went on TV after the shocking disaster of a situation when she'd just been killed by Tillicum. And SeaWorld, in this rather kind of careful way, while saying, we're all so sad and it was such a terrible thing, it was really trying to put the blame for this on her, on the
right.
On the trainer. And the judge simply wouldn't have any of this. He said SeaWorld knew perfectly well what the dangers were. In fact, there'd just been a situation just, I think it was 2 months previously, at a park, a marine park, a circus in the Canary Islands that SeaWorld is connected to, where another trainer had been killed. And then he cited many other examples as well where people have been either killed or injured or hurt or whatever, including at SeaWorld San Diego. And he said, so this simply doesn't hold up, I mean, just all the way. And he ended up then ruling basically that there has to be some physical barrier between the orcas and the humans. And yes. That's really the big thing. So that leaves SeaWorld in a bit of a quandary now as to whether they're going to appeal the judge's decision or whether they're just going to kind of let the whole thing go and redesign the show. The one thing, incidentally, that he did let SeaWorld off the hook for just a little bit, and the SeaWorld folks have been out there saying, aha, well, we really won because, is he took the violation down from being a willful neglect, which is what OSHA said it was, which is the most serious kind of violation you can have, to simply being a serious violation. Now, that's a very small difference. It's a technical difference, and it really hangs on whether what SeaWorld was doing was simply flying totally in the face of everything that they knew and that they had to know that this would happen sooner or later. He said, we just can't prove that one way or the other, so we're going to call it a serious violation, and he reduced the fine from $75,000 to, I think it was $12,000, any of which is just pocket change from SeaWorld's point of view.
Indeed. Now, to my knowledge, we haven't heard anything from Don's family along these proceedings. Is that correct? And if so, where are they?
They were in court all the way through, and it was a really sad situation for them. I mean, they just looked, from everything I heard. I wasn't there in the courtroom, but from the people who were there, we heard that the family just looked just absolutely devastated by all of this and just kind of, are going through the whole thing. But they haven't said anything at all. And I'm just conjecturing here, but I believe that the reason is that SeaWorld basically, putting it crudely, paid them off. I mean, they set up a foundation in the name of Dawn Branshaw and did things like that. And I would conjecture that this was all kind of on the understanding that the family would not be suing SeaWorld would not start saying rude things about them.
Yes. Now, what do you, since you're conjecturing, what do you think SeaWorld is going to do regarding perhaps altering or modifying their show?
Well, what the people who kind of know about this kind of thing, the other trainers who used to be with SeaWorld and who kind of have an idea about this, is, well, SeaWorld's already talked about setting up these kind of what they call sort of false floors at the bottom of the pools that can be raised up in a hurry, and that would effectively sort of beach the orcas if something like that happened. They're also talking about having special kind of oxygen devices that a trainer could put on if there was a problem. So we don't know exactly, but we do know that they've been experimenting with all of this and that they're still kind of trying to figure it out. But at the moment, it is still the case, as far as I know, that there are actually, that the old routines of having trainers kind of suddenly being swept out of the water on the rostrum, that's like the nose of the yes. orcas, which were the so-called most exciting parts of the show, those haven't been happening since the incident a year ago.
Yeah. So as you mentioned earlier, and just to conclude this brief discussion, this case was about the safety of people, not so much about the well-being of whales or sea mammals or the ethics of the whole enterprise. What's your advice for enlightened folks who don't want to support this industry? What should individuals do to help end this practice?
It's very simple. I mean, we just say one thing to everybody. Don't buy a ticket. Those are the words, actually, of the famous Rick O'Barry, who used to be the trainer of Flipper back in the 60s. I think everybody knows about him. And he goes around the world saying this to everybody. Just don't buy a ticket. Let's just put this thing out of business.
Right. Okay, well,
thing everybody can do. If you want to go and see orcas, go out on a whale-watching boat or go and visit the dolphins out in the ocean, but don't go to any of these marine circuses.
Great advice. Michael Mountain, thank you very much for joining us on Animals Today.
Thanks for having us on.
Stick around. I've got some news items and a pet product review. You're listening to Animals Today.
Time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future.
Welcome back to Animals Today. I never said I hated that bump. I just think it's a little obnoxious, that's all. You know, Peter, you're talking to Michael Mountain, which was, it was a wonderful interview, by the way, about the OSHA SeaWorld hearings. I recently saw an interview, I think it was on, I believe it was on CNN, and it was a debate with Jack Hanna, the wonderful Jack Hanna, and another gentleman, Jack Kirby, I believe. And Jack Hanna, with his typical silly losing arguments, obviously always in support of the industry.
Yes.
Makes the same old case. Where else can you see these magnificent creatures?
Right.
Well, Michael just gave us ideas in the last segment of where you can see these magnificent creatures without doing anything unethical or inhumane.
Yeah, it's such a clever rhetorical trick,
right,
to put it out there as if the obvious answer is nowhere else.
Right. This is such a huge educational benefit.
And
you learned so much.
And
about
I have also seen him extend that, saying, look at how popular this is, therefore it's a good thing.
Right, right.
Well, therefore you have a great marketing.
It's not logical. Exactly, exactly. Like I said, it's always in support of the industry. Okay, so what's in the news?
Well, first I want to tell you about a neat product that we've been looking at. Debbie actually mentioned her earlier in the hour. Debbie from Pilots and Paws told us that PetMate.
Oh, PetMate! She did mention PetMate.
Has been supplying the carriers,
yeah,
for some of their animals so they can go on the plane
That's
safely.
That's so nice of
well,
them.
Well, I will remind you, we've been working with our demonstrator model, and I received this in the mail. I put it together myself without breaking it, and it's a small carrier for 10 to 20 pound animals, and this is neat because it has two doors. It's got a front door that opens, and it's also got a top door.
Okay.
So if you've got an animal that you can't shove in through one door or persuade to go into one door, you can flip the top up and just sort of drop them in.
Okay, so that's what I see in the middle of the living room floor.
In the middle, they say you're supposed to do that to acclimate your animals to the carrier.
Right, and it's good, and I love this door on top because some animals, they just all four of their paws just like hang on for dear life, and before their body goes in there, you know, they just don't want to be dragged in there.
Right.
So it's much easier just to open the top, put them in gently, and then close it down. Really good. And so, we used it.
So,
we tried it once.
So thanks. Good, anyway, good. Thanks to PetMate for
very
being
nice.
Generous.
Good, good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, the American mountain lions probably make staging a comeback. Did you know that?
No.
Also known as the cougar, right?
Right.
My alma mater, by the way.
Ah, that's right.
They used to be found throughout North America, and now their populations are sort of scattered and very isolated. Well, researchers have been studying them over years, looking at their carcasses, unfortunately, the tracks, camera trap photos, DNA evidence, and video evidence to draw the conclusions that the number of cougars, especially in the Midwest, around the South Dakota Black Hills, are increasing.
Good.
So that's good for the cougar population. And if you remember, a couple of years ago, last year, one cougar made its way all the way to Connecticut by foot, they believe. Unfortunately, he was killed by a car. But it just was taken as evidence that there are more cougars, and they are roaming when they are capable.
Until the poachers find them and kill them.
Well, the cougars are doing somewhat better. So, yes, I imagine a lot of people would like to take one out for the sport of it. That's true.
Yeah.
But There is a angry animal rights activist who has been protesting against a Wayne State University professor. This is a psychology professor, a physiology professor doing cardiovascular research at the medical school, and he works on dogs and rats. Well, this person is claiming that it is her First Amendment, that it's her free speech right to send threatening emails and to him, and putting down a post physically threatening him. And she's saying, well, she didn't really mean to carry it out. So that is going through the courts right now. She's got a defense attorney saying her actions are free speech and protected by the U.S. Constitution. However, she is charged with aggravated stalking, unlawful posting of messages online, and both are five-year felonies as well as trespassing.
How is a threat?
Uh-huh.
How is the threat under the Freedom of Speech Act?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty thin also if you tell somebody you're going to cut off his limbs with rusty saws and rip his teeth out one by one, which is the allegation.
But she doesn't mean to
she
carry it
mean
out.
Mean it. She's just saying.
Okay.
So I don't think she's going to get very far. That's pretty much everything I know about constitutional law right there, and I'm going to guess she's going to go to prison.
Okay.
I just put my chips down right there.
Okay.
Okay. And in, you know, there have been the longest love affair known to anybody of two Galapagos tortoises that have been living together for 115 years in Austria. Okay. They have been there since they were born in 1897, grew up together, and later became a couple. And they've been together ever since. Until recently, when one of them started biting the other. And yes, they're breaking up.
No!
Yeah.
So do they have to be separated?
They've separated them.
Oh,
They're hoping that the flame will get rekindled, but they couldn't stand the sight of each other, and something must have happened after 115 years to make them change their minds.
Well, we've been married, 11 years?
11 years.
Okay, it's still going strong, can you imagine 100?
No biting, though.
Can you imagine over 100 years?
Yes. So that's the tortoise, Bibi and Poldi, that's a long marriage.
Any babies?
You know, in my sources, I don't know about babies.
Yeah.
But isn't it amazing the lifespan of a huge tortoise?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
So they can live to be 150 years or older.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Thank you.
You bet.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And thank you for tuning into our show. This is Animals Today. And you're listening to Animals Today. Check us out, animalstodayradio.com. Like us on Facebook, whatever it's called, that thing that you go on every single day and spend most of your hours doing. This is Dr. Lori Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.